ladies taking their tea, and Fool smiled and led Molly past. At the entrance to the first gallery was a table with small brochures, like programmes to an opera, and he took one with a dignified bow, Molly on his arm. There were crowds even at that hour, and he was pleased to see this. At a small exhibit of watercolours of the Thames, he stopped and read a few lines and studied the guard, seated on his stool near the entrance, and then he moved with Molly forward to the second long gallery, and paused and read further. The brochure said nothing about any works in the gallery, except the one astonishing painting all had come to see. As they drifted with the crowds, Fool studied the floor. The gallery consisted of two long, horseshoe-shaped rooms, connected at each end. In the centre, at the rear, a wide staircase with satin ropes for handrails ascended to the second floor and opened onto a hallway, from which several small alcoves extended. At the front of the second floor, in the largest space, hung the most famous painting in England, Fool's painting, his Charlotte. They let the crowds carry them up. It was, it seemed, the work of one Joseph Wright of Derby. Wright had titled the painting Iphigenia in the Mirror. He had come to London to have his subject sit for him and had worked on the painting on commission, but he had never been paid, and the painting had been thought lost for 90 years. It had been found hanging in the cottage of a retired schoolmistress outside Derby, who claimed her father had accepted it in lieu of payment of a debt. The intrepid Mr. Farquhar had known the work at once. He had offered the schoolmistress £10, but she had insisted on 12 or no sale. All of this was written up in the brochure provided, as well as the expected price at auction. It was believed the work would fetch upward of £30,000. Fool smiled to himself and passed the brochure to Molly and folded his hands behind his back and shifted in the crowd to get closer. There was a gentleman in a green frock coat standing at the door, taking 1 and 6 from each viewer as they passed, and providing them with a ticket stub for re-entry. There was something condescending and reserved about the man, despite his elegance, and Fool liked the look of him, and suspected he must be Farquhar himself. The fellow would do nicely, Fool thought, very nicely. He paid and went in, and there it was. Though titled Iphigenia by Wright, the newspapers had taken to calling it simply the Emma. For the woman whose face Fool had known so powerfully was a young Emma Hart, later Lady Hamilton, lover of Lord Nelson and the most notorious seductress of her day. Wright had only painted her the once. She had been born into a life of drudgery, but by the age of 16 was dancing naked on tables for the private stag parties of her betters. She had slid from bed to bed, trailing silk sheets behind her, and found herself eventually wed to a dying man twice her age, and living in Naples. There she had displayed herself to Goethe, and to visiting monarchs, and had studied the classical ruins around her for their elegance and fascination. Buried inside her was a fascination of her own that she longed to reach. Wright's vision of Emma had been an unhappy one, a study of frail lights burning against an overwhelming darkness. She sat central to the canvas, surrounded by gloom, but for a single candle burning low on the table to her left, and she stared with a livid and scorched expression directly out from the canvas. Her eyes were the eyes of Charlotte. Her dread and furious sorrow were Charlotte's. He knew that farewell, knew what she was leaving. In the background all was shadow, but as he stared, Fool began to distinguish a second figure, only just visible. It hulked there, unaccounted for and ominous, and Fool knew it at once. He wet his lips and leaned upon his walking stick, and the room seemed to go quiet around him, and he might have been alone with the painting for all that he was aware of the crowd around him. He stared. That figure, he knew, was her future self coming towards her. It was her death.
"Mr. Fool," a voice said at his elbow.
He turned in surprise. He did not at first know the man.
"What an unexpected pleasure, sir,"
the man was saying. "And how are you enjoying London? How is your lovely daughter?" It was the phrenologist from the Orania, the man who had ruined him at whist and taken his silver pocket watch as payment. Fool smiled an elegant smile, slid into his room.
"She is excellent, sir. We both find London most stimulating. I'm pleased to hear it. I trust you are staying away from the cards?
Fool had taken the man's elbow and drawn him to one side of the crowd, and he frowned at this jibe, but did not respond to it. He had caught a glimpse of Flood's massive figure drifting through the crowds, Mrs. Sykes on his arm, her cheeks chafed with cold. He lowered his gaze, cleared his throat.
"What brings you to London, sir?"
he asked. The phrenologist tugged at the cuffs of his grey coat, raised both eyebrows in answer.
"Why, this painting, of course," he said.
"All of England has an interest in it. I wanted to see it for myself before it was lost to the auction."
"Perhaps you will be lucky," Fool said. "Perhaps its new owner will appreciate a game of whist."
The phrenologist smiled.
"Ha! Very good. It is an extraordinary beauty, is it not?"
"Indeed, sir," the man nodded. But just then a colour rose to his cheeks, and he lifted his chin as if swallowing back some sourness, and Fool followed his gaze. It was Flood, drifting towards the painting. When the phrenologist glanced back down at Fool, his white lips had thinned, and his eyelids were heavy, and there was in his face some slow, horrified dawning. Fool withdrew the silver pocket watch, with the unblinking eye inlaid upon it, and he clicked the lid smoothly open with his thumb, and he cradled the watch in his left palm.
"Well, it is 11:52, sir," he said pleasantly. "Midday does approach."
And he looked up, and he met the man's startled eye with a cold and murderous gaze. Edward was issued a small gambler's pistol with an enameled grip, which he tucked into the fold of his stocking. He would stump up the major stairs at 5 o'clock in the morning, and scrape his boots, and enter to find the Scot already seated at his desk, coffee steaming before him. Edward's task was to scratch out the man's dictation by the light of a weak sconce lamp, and to lose nothing in the speed. The major kept him close. In the afternoons, he sat in draughty waiting rooms, hat on his knee, while a cold rain drummed the windows. At night, he lugged a satchel filled with papers across the muddied street to the safe house, and made a fair copy of the day's correspondence. Some nights he found a clothed stranger asleep in his cot, sullen-looking, bearded, dirty. In the morning that man would be gone, leaving only the folded blanket and a stink of tobacco as proof that any had been there at all. A kindness began to creep in. One Tuesday the major took him by carriage into the city. At a tailor shop, he stood shivering in stained underclothes while a Frenchman fussed around him with swatches of fabric and scissors. Across the street, a haberdasher wrapped the cold measuring tape around his skull, disapproving. Later a barber waved a straight razor in a mirror, smiling at the major, pretending to shave the boy's smooth cheeks. Perched on an army wagon under an overcast sky, the major told Edward how he had come over from Edinburgh in his youth. His ship had been wrecked off Nova Scotia, and he and his wife came ashore on a beach somewhere off Sable Island, half drowned. This was in the cold, under a web of stars, and they were taken in by a fisherman there for the week, until word could get out, and a ship could come for them. He and his wife were the only survivors. Edward listened to this, thinking of Mrs. Shade's descriptions of his true father, trying to recall, through a haze, some memory of the Atlantic, of ships, of salt water and wood. On the last night of April, before Edward was dismissed, the major reached into his desk drawer and withdrew an important-looking envelope. There was a government seal upon it.
"This, lad,"
he said gruffly, "is a pardon for the man who sold you out. Fisk. You know the man I mean." The major rose and walked to the stove in the far corner, and banged open its grilled door, a pulsing red heat from the coals within. He stuffed the envelope in, using a poker, and then he shut the door with a clang and blew on his fingers. His brutal eyes lifted, met Edward's.
"The bastard'll button tea," he said softly. "Just that easy."
The next day at Camp Barry, he stood beside the major in the general's quarters, listening to a proposal to move against the Confederate capital of Richmond. He was wearing his new suit, a grey silk hat, a pink pinstriped vest. Afterwards, the major waded the deep mud of the mustering yard, and they entered the stockade, and Edward stood in the hushed gloom, staring at the condemned men there, feeling nothing. The air reeked. He did not say a word. He could see the tangled white beard of Fisk where he lay in the straw, frail and sick, a bony wrist covering his eyes. That afternoon, in a hired carriage as they rattled back through the streets, the Major reached out and gripped the boy's forearm. His fingers felt hot. "Where do you hail from, lad?" Edward looked away.
"No place, sir. My people all are dead."
The Major grunted and withdrew his hand, a cigar smouldering between his teeth. "When this is all over, you'll come to work for me in Chicago," he said quietly. He raised an eyebrow, studied the boy's reaction in the settling darkness. "You know who I am, what it is I do." Edward stared.
"Yes, sir. Mr. Pinkerton," he whispered. "Thank you, sir."
The Major turned his face to the window.
"You're wrong about your family, lad," he muttered. "There's the family you're born to, and the family you make. It's the latter kind that lasts."
Fool stayed at the Farquhar Gallery late. He sent Molly home by hansom, with a fatherly pat on her arm and dignified instructions to the driver, and he watched her sweet, crestfallen happiness and wished it could have been real, that this could have been her childhood in truth. When she had gone, he sat in a cafe at the entrance to Burlington Arcade and watched the constable walk his beat and the gallery's watchman trade off his shift and the crowds ebb and flow. When he returned to 82 Half Moon Street, it was late, and he fumbled on the unlit step like a burglar, then withdrew his key. But when he went to unlock the door, he found it already unlocked. He went in feeling uneasy. The house was cold. He stood just within the door, then closed it behind him and stood longer, listening to the floors creak above him. On the pier table he saw the gloves he had forgotten. Then a muffled clatter came from below and he crossed to the stairs and peered down. He could see the dull orange glow of a light from the kitchen there, and without taking off his hat or setting down his walking stick, he moved stealthily down and stooped and entered the kitchen. The counters, wiped and tidy, pots hanging from their hooks in the candle fire, the linoleum gleaming as if just waxed, a metallic stink of poison in the air. At the cutting table, with her back to him and her face turned away, stooped a wide-hipped figure, feet planted powerfully apart, elbows sharpened and moving.
"Mrs. Sykes," Fool said.
She looked around at him in alarm.
"Mr. Fool," she said. "Why, you scared the daylights out of me, you did. I were just..."
But then she faltered and trailed off and glanced behind her at the candles burning down in the pantry where her bed had been laid out. He could see the straw ticking and the fusty brown blanket and a basin of water under the nearest shelf of dry goods. There was a nightgown folded upon it. The door to the scullery was closed, and he heard muffled snoring from beyond, and he knew Hetty would be asleep in her own darkness there.
"Forgive me, sir," Mrs. Sykes said, "but you shouldn't be down here. It ain't right."
"And you shouldn't be working this late." He waved a tired hand, stepped forward and removed his hat and sat down at the table across from her.
"Neither of us cares about what's proper. You must know that. Did you enjoy the paintings?" "I don't mean proper, sir. I mean it ain't right."
He gave her a long, searching look. Something shifted in her, and she put down the silver and the polishing rag and regarded him.
"Are you all right, sir?"
she asked.
"It's nothing. I'm tired."
She screwed the lid back on to the bromide.
"Might you eat a wee bite, sir?"
The way she asked it made him think of Mrs. Shade a lifetime ago, and he sat with his head sunk into his chest and his palm flat on the table, and then he nodded.
"Did you know, Mrs. Sykes, that I was caught in the American War?" "Aye, sir. Mr. Flood might have said so."
Fool paused, studied her.
"Did he tell you the circumstances?" "Ah, no, sir. He said it was no business of his to tell. Only that the two of you met in the war."
She gave him a look.
"Should he not have said?"
"Probably not," he said, but he smiled to soften it.
"I wasn't even 15. I enlisted for the pay. Imagine. I had no idea what it would be like, the killing. He looked up at her. I shouldn't be here by rights.
Go far enough back in any life, sir, and the same's true of all of us.
I guess so.
She smiled.
There was a major I served under. A good man, tough, stubborn, but he knew what he knew, and there was no telling him different. He was a cooper in Scotland in his youth, and he ran from the English all the way to America. He wasn't so big, but he had thick cooper's arms, and when he shook your hand, it felt like a vice. He taught me the one lesson I've never forgotten. Revenge, justice, they're just two sides of the one coin. Whichever side you stare at doesn't matter. When you spend it, it's worth the same. I loved that man. I loved him like a father.
Fool raised his face.
He tried to have me killed.
Mrs. Sykes put down the rag on the table and stared.
He done what? He sent a man to kill me.
She gave him a long, appraising look.
It don't do to dwell too much on what's gone, Mr. Fool, she sighed. It ain't easy, I know it. I tell Hetty the past is writ, but tomorrow ain't never existed before, not in the whole history of the world.
As she spoke, he watched her eyes shift towards the door behind him, and he wondered at it. He heard a heavy footfall in the hall above and knew it, and he listened to Flood pause and pause, and then go noisily back up the stairs, and he was surprised to hear the giant still awake. He wondered if his friend was wanting him for something. But then he saw Mrs. Sykes blush and dip her head to hide it, and all at once he understood why she was awake at that hour. He flushed suddenly.
"Forgive me," he said to her. "I'm keeping you."
"Nonsense," she said.
"I am," he said. "Tomorrow will come early enough."
"All right,"
she said.
"I'll be going up now."
"All right."
He took the candle and went up. He saw no sign of Flood as he returned to his room, nor as he shut the door, nor blew out the candle. He stood a long time in the darkness, watching the grey ribbon of smoke from the candle fade. Somewhere above him a door opened and shut, and then a heavy tread descended the stairs, and passed his room, and descended again, and then the house was silent.
Flood and Mrs. Sykes?
He took off his coat and trousers and necktie, and went to his window. He stared out at the gaslit street. It felt unexpected, what was in him, like an immense and secret happiness. Could the world be other than it was? He passed a hand over his eyes. Just so. The world could be other than it was.
28.
His unkillable father, knifed 14 times, shot 4, badly beaten twice, struck once in the throat with such force that he was hospitalized for a week. He had suffered a stroke in 1871 that should have crippled him for the rest of his days, but had, through force of will, dragged his dead leg behind him on daily walks, and slowly regained a semblance of speech. In his late years, he would change his shirt in his afternoon office, while William sat in an armchair and went over the morning's meetings, watching the old man undress. There was the ugly body, the ropey sinews and slack skin under the arms, the flattened breasts shuddering as he bent at the waist, the folds of flesh bunching there. But the eyes were hard, small, dark, and the set of his mouth was impatient with intelligence. As he had aged, he had lost his physical sensitivity, and by the end, he did not shake a hand, but gripped it. He did not close a door, but slammed it. All was strength, and the exhibition of strength, as if he could defeat his own decline through stubbornness alone. On William's first night back from Santa Fe, he sat in his pajamas at the foot of his own bed, his white feet planted on the carpet, while Margaret brushed and brushed her hair at the mirror. He was thinking about his father's unkillable nature. An attempt had been made on his father's life in Windsor, Canada, over 15 years ago. That was in 1868, the year of the Reno business. His father had gone north in pursuit of the last of that gang, and a salesman walking behind him on the ramp as he disembarked from the ferry withdrew a revolver from his samples case and held it to the back of his father's head and pulled the trigger.
He did what?
Margaret lowered her hairbrush, studied him in the mirror with shining eyes.
You never told me about this.
I didn't want you to worry.
Was the gun not loaded?
William grunted, shifted his bulk. The bedspring shivered, creaking.
It should have killed him, he said. I guess Pa felt the man there at the last minute and turned around and somehow got his thumb jammed in the hammer of the revolver. Broke his thumb doing it.
Your father,
Margaret said. William studied her straight back, her white neck, her long hair drawn down over one shoulder. He nodded. He knocked the fellow down. The man later told the police he'd been hired by us for the publicity, that it was all a stunt. That night he escaped or they let him go. Our operatives caught up to him, of course. We took him down to the docks and questioned him ourselves. Turned out he'd been hired by Sam Felker.
Sam Felker?
William nodded vaguely. Some four-flashing penny detective trying to make a go of his own business in Detroit at the time. I guess he'd been thinking to get Pa out of the way. He laid his head back on the pillow. He was remembering the gleam in his father's eyes, the triumph as he studied the assassin's swollen face in the half-light of that grimy room, the sound of the man's bones cracking, freighters bellowing and men hollering on the docks outside the warehouse, the three operatives motionless in shadow, their fists double-wrapped like pugilists.
What happened to Felker?
William raised his head. Margaret was still watching him in the mirror.
Felker? Nothing. I think he went broke a few years later.
She doused the lamp and slipped into the bed beside him.
I never imagined I was marrying into a family of lunatics.
He smiled into her hair in the darkness.
Ma's not crazy.
Your mother's the worst of the lot.
But she said it gently, with a smile in her voice, and then she slid a soft leg over his thighs and straddled him. She held the finger to his lips.
We have to be quiet, she whispered. The girls will hear.
A low cloud lay over the city. He had worn his oilskin and was walking fast, his shoulders hunched and walking stick raised, but the rain held off. In the streets, he slipped between carts and wagons, squelched through the mud, shouldered past beggars and clerks and shoppers, all massed on the footways, and seemingly pushing against him. His stomach was tight. As he went, he thought how easy it would be to lose shade. His visit to Rose Utterson might have already tipped his hand, and the man could be preparing his departure even now, could be already gone. Edward Shade had not eluded his father for 20 years by being careless. In the crooked lane, some of the peeling red and black posters had been ripped down by the rain during the night and lay crushed in the muck of the sets. William kicked aside a broken milk tin, its bottom blown out, and watched it rattle sharply off a bollard. He saw no one. After the roar of the streets, the lane felt eerie, still, a place out of time. The stained brick walls, the mist drifting through, the quiet dripping of water into the gutters. At the small gunsmithing shop with Gleason's in gold script on the windows, he paused, glanced behind him, scraped his shoes, and then went in. A man looked up as he entered. He had blooming whiskers badly kept, and a leather apron tied off over a green frock coat, and in his hand he gripped a small, sharp hammer. The shop was dim, dusty, cold. William walked straight for him, his eyes level.
You're Gleason.
Hadley Gleason, sir, at your service?
Wiping his hand in his apron, holding it out.
And what are you in need of today, sir?
Where's the boy?
The gunsmith cocked an ear as if he had misheard.
Albert, don't get in till 10 o'clock, sir,
he said slowly.
If it's about a piece, I'd say I know the trade a fair bit better than the boy do.
I'll wait.
It's not about that Showalt girl now, is it?
William paused.
He swears it weren't him. Now, I'm inclined to believe a girl in distress, but Albert, well, he may be rough, but he ain't so rough as that.
William gave him a look.
It's not about the girl, he said.
Although there was an alley-side loading bay into the cellar, there was no back entrance. William took in the shop. Smaller, shabbier in the daylight, and drifted to one corner, the gunsmith watching him the while. When the boy came in, William had been lurking to one side of the door, and he waited until the door had shut, and then he stepped forward. Gleason called to the boy at the same moment.
"Albert," he said, "this gentleman here has some business with you. Make it quick now. I've a week's worth of work for you and half a day to get it done."
Albert had already turned in alarm, his greasy, pinched face squinching down. His hair was thinning and long over the ears, and William found it difficult to imagine the boy getting any girl in trouble. He put a big hand on Albert's sleeve and drew him, struggling, to one side of the door.
"You remember me," he said softly.
Albert glared fearful from under his eyebrows. The gunsmith Gleason was watching from behind his counter, a hunting rifle in one hand, a small gun key in the other.
"I have a message for Mr. Foon."
William withdrew from the lining of his oilskin a 5-pound note, and he crushed it into Albert's palm. A quick, sly, nervous glance across the shop.
"I'll see he gets it, I will."
William nodded.
"You tell Mr. Foon there has been a development in the Blackfriars Bridge matter. Tell him Charlotte might not have gone for a swim after all."
He squinted up, as if looking for some advantage.
"Charlotte?"
"Just tell him."
William turned to go.
"And Albert?"
The boy studied him, sullen, pale.
"I?"
"You stay away from that girl."
All morning he waited, drifting from shop to shop, smoking in the shuttered doorways. It did not rain. "A man is nothing without patience," his father used to say. "Patience and a loaded gun." When Albert went out at noon, William followed as far as the Fisherman's Hook pub, two streets over, and he watched through the streaked windows as the boy ate alone and sucked the sauce from his fingers. At 2 o'clock, the gunsmith Gleason went out with a heavy satchel, clanking over one shoulder, and shortly after that, the boy took down the sign and closed up shop, and proceeded at a brisk pace in the direction of Piccadilly. William slid like a shadow along the wall, following. Albert turned from the tumult of Piccadilly into Half Moon Street, and trudged up the steps of a tall terraced house there, and he buzzed the tradesman's bell and then turned and slid around the side of the house. It was number 82. A low wrought iron railing with a swing gate propped open ran alongside the pavement, and the steps, William noticed, were a cut white stone, which the gunsmith's apprentice had sullied with his boots. William stood in his oilskin under a gaslight across the street and watched the side yard where the boy had disappeared. He could see no movement, and at last he risked cutting across to the far side and walking slowly past the house. He caught a glimpse of the gunsmith's apprentice talking to a young boy. He walked on 20 paces, then took off his coat and folded it over his arm, and cut back to the far side of the street and retraced his steps. It was then he saw Albert, walking quickly back in the direction of Waterloo Place. William took off his hat and ran a hand through his hair there in the street, and stared after the apprentice, and then he turned and peered up at the house. It must be Fool's, surely. But he did not go up. He took careful note of the address and set his hat on his head and slipped his arms through his oilskin. Just then the front door opened and the boy emerged.
"You, boy," he called roughly.
He jogged across the street, caught the boy at the gate. But when the child turned, he saw in surprise it was a girl. 10, maybe 11 years old. She stared up at him with a snub nose, freckled, her red lips down-turned in a pout. Her dark eyes were hard, too knowing. He instinctively lowered his voice.
"Do you work here? Who's your master?"
The girl scowled.
"Ma what?"
He was in no temper. He thought a fool coming down the street, and he grabbed the girl by the upper arm. He pulled her onto the footway.
"Who lives here?"
She glared sullenly up at him.
"And what's that to you? Let go my arm!"
"I'm looking for an acquaintance. Lives near here. A man named Fool."
"An acquaintance, is it? Do tell."
He stared off in the direction the apprentice had gone.
"What did you and the gunsmith's boy talk about?"
he asked, all at once uncertain. He was starting to think he had made a mistake. The girl blinked.
"Albert, the apprentice."
She glanced angrily away. And then William understood. He had the wrong house.
For God's sake, he muttered. Your name isn't Showalter, by chance.
Just then there came a sharp cry from the house, and he turned and saw a stout housekeeper shaking out a rag, glaring down at him from the step.
What's this, then? Fondling the wee ones when you don't reckon anyone like to catch it, is it?
William gave her a startled look, loosened his grip on the girl. She slid nimbly out of his reach.
Bloody damned American bastard, she swore.
And then she was gone at a run down into the bustle and crowds of Piccadilly and lost to view. He turned, one hand on the cold gate, his eyes fixed on the housekeeper.
You,
he said.
Mean nothing. I've a mind to call for the constable.
I'm looking for someone,
William called up. He opened the creaking gate.
Wait.
I don't give a black rat what you be looking for. Off with you now.
Wait. A Mr. Fool. Adam Fool.
Go on, get.
She stumped back into the house, slammed the door. William climbed the steps and paused, listening, and then he knocked sharply. She did not answer. He lifted his eyes and glimpsed two gentlemen, canes looped over their wrists, standing on the footway, watching. He grimaced. He would need to return to the gunsmith's apprentice and find a more direct line of questioning, he knew. He started to go, then paused, his eye catching on something to one side of the door, a small brass plaque screwed into the railing. Fool's Rare Goods Emporium, Imports and Exports, by appointment only.
Son of a bitch, he muttered.
There had been another side to his father. All was not brimstone and fire, or not only. He was also a man whose greatest pleasure lay in making something from nothing, in the building of spaces, architectures, lives. He had stumbled back out of frailty and retirement when the fire swept through Chicago 14 years earlier, devastating the old agency offices. William had watched him pick his way through the charred rubble, leaning heavily on his arm, already describing the massive building he would erect in its place. And for 10 years the old man had designed and planted larches on his sprawling ranch property in Illinois, the farmhouse and pavilions filling with art and books and murals of General McClellan from the war. William stood in the shadowed foyer of what would soon be his mother's house in Chicago, listening to the old clock punch through its minutes, feeling the living presence of his parents on the floor above. His mother would be snoring, his father down the hall in the morning room, half awake and in pain. William put on his hat, sighed. The summer lane was abloom with darkness beyond, fragrant and dense and heavy. He stood listening like that, remembering, knowing his father would soon be gone from the earth, that he would not again hear that voice, see that face. Let him stay like this, he thought, though the man suffered and faded daily. He closed his eyes.
Let him stay like this, Lord, he whispered. Let him suffer just a little while longer.
29. In those first long months after the war, Edward would remember his time at Fort Monroe with the Union Army and how his own happiness had eaten away at him, how he had stared at his face in the small shaving glass tied to a post in the tent by one of the older conscripts, seeking out some resemblance to the major, the cut of a tooth, flare of a nostril. If he saw in Alan Pinkerton the slope of his own shoulder, he could be excused, perhaps, on account of his past. All this he would think of in years to come, with a kind of heartbreak and bellicosity. He took to standing the way the major stood, with his arms crossed and wrists tucked under, and his chin sucked down to his chest, and he would screw his eyes into slits and bite down on the stick as if it were a cigar. He too would argue or sullenly disdain the Washington cabal. He too admired General McClellan in his stern elegance. He too regarded the ragged Negro runners emerging from the wilderness with the pity and compassion of a man who had, for 20 years, fought for their freedoms. All this, and the almost undetectable burr that would come into his voice as he grew agitated, as if he, too, had put a childhood in the gaubles behind him. He was not yet what he was, what he might be. Then came the news from Richmond of the arrest of the Major's spies, and Edward's life took its last impossible turn. He had been a different creature then, the war raging and his several lives already ended, and a man whom others feared offering him kindness. Fool sat in the drawing-room, thinking this, the big bay windows looking east into the fire of the rising sun. He watched the slow creep of light across the carpet like a luminescence, alive and with purpose. Up over the piano, down the potted palm, standing in its curve. Setting the twin wooden pails from Antwerp alight, the brass candlesticks from Ghent. He watched this and thought, that is how the past creeps. Something had passed between him and the detective that no other had a share in. He thought of the shadows in Rose Atterson's voice that night, as the possession took hold of her, and how, in that moment, he had recoiled like a man burned. Pinkerton had gone back to question her, and now, it seemed, he had come by the Emporium. Fool sat with his fingers interlaced before him, only his eyes moving, sucking at his anger like a sore tooth. Molly had told him about it the evening before, describing the man in his dark mustaches and the strength in his grip. She had rolled up her sleeve, bared the bruises from his fingers.
"I weren't afraid of him," she said, too boldly. "I reckon he were afraid of me."
Now the light was crawling over the table's long curve, over the ladder-back chairs. Flood and Molly sat with heads bowed. They were going through the morning papers seeking word of the painting and the coming auction. The more publicity now, the greater the impact of the theft later, he knew. He stared tiredly at Flood and Molly where they sat, the big circular table gleaming under the gasolier, watching them slip their uncut pages steadily in the stillness, folding the penknife and passing it across and unfolding it again. So far, only a small article on the third page of the Gazette had mentioned the painting and the auction, and Fool had read it with misgiving. The article seemed uninterested, cursory. Everywhere, instead, was talk of empire and savagery and the wounded honour of the British Lion. Last night, news had reached London of General Gordon's death at Khartoum, and the morning pages were filled with it.
Bloody hell.
Flood was running his big hand over his beard in puzzlement.
"Mr. Edom," he said, "where's this Khartoum at, then? It ain't in Africa, is it?"
Molly glanced up from her newspaper.
"Where's what?"
"Khartoum. The Khartoum."
Fool lifted one sore shoulder and rubbed at his eyes.
"You're meant to be looking for articles on the Emma."
Molly took the newspaper from Flood's grasp and studied it.
"Oh, the Khartoum. In Mexico. Where that General Gordon got himself killed."
Flood frowned.
"Mexico?
You ever been there?"
Flood shook his head.
"Right,"
she nodded.
"Mexico. Whole cities carved out of the rocks what they live under, like. All built out of tunnels and such. That's where it gets its name from. Khartoum."
Flood stabbed a finger at the paper.
"That says there an expeditionary force was sent from Cairo to relieve them. Got there 2 days too late."
Molly scanned the article, nodded thoughtfully.
"Oh, they mean Cairo, Mexico," she said. "It's a city near the ocean. It was called that on account of its pyramids."
"Pyramids, me ass. Where do it say pyramids?"
"They got pyramids in Mexico. Not like in Egypt, but they got pyramids."
"Mr. Edom, you hearing this?"
Fool grunted.
"They have pyramids in Mexico, Japheth. Mexican pyramids. Where they do not have pyramids is in Mr. Farquhar's gallery. Keep looking."
Just then Flood stood, his face reddening, his big shoulders bunching to avoid the gasolier.
Mrs. Sykes stood in the door.
"Aye, that General Gordon," she said. "Ask me any jack what's foolish enough to just sit and wait while a horde of savages walks right on up to his door and rings the buzzer don't deserve much else. Imagine."
Flood cleared his throat and said, shyly,
"You don't consider it were maybe just a wee bit noble, fighting them savages?"
She snorted.
"Noble now, is it?"
Flood's face fell.
"There's some as wouldn't know noble if it climbed up into their lap.
As she spoke, she stared at the floor, and she could not bring herself to give the giant a direct glance. She wrung her hands out in her apron, glanced up at Fool.
"You wanted to see me, sir. Will you be wanting some tea and biscuit?"
Fool shifted in his chair. "Molly said a man came by the house yesterday."
"He did, sir."
"And mighty pleased with his own self he was. Man handling the lass like that? I didn't care for the look of him." "What did he want?" Mrs. Sykes blinked.
"Why, you, sir. He was to asking after you."
Molly chewed at her lip.
"Albie from Gleason's come by first, saying he had a message for you. I reckon he were followed."
Fool felt something shift inside him, some deep misgiving. "What was the message?" Molly shrugged.
"Never said. I expect it weren't nothing. An attempt to get Albie to lead him here."
Mrs. Sykes was wiping her hands on her spotted apron, the old yellow stains of some mess not quite bleached out there. She cleared her throat.
"Will there be anything else, sir? Tea and biscuit?"
"Biscuit, why?" Flood said loudly. "Be lovely."
Mrs. Sykes paid him no mind.
"Tea would be fine, yes,"
Fool said.
"And for Miss Molly?"
she said. Molly grinned at her. As she turned to go, Mrs. Sykes gave a quick, pointed look at Flood, where he stood stiff and formal, with his arms at his sides, and then she went back out.
"I do adore a nice bit of biscuit,"
Molly said. She stretched her arms in a theatrical gesture, and smiled and rubbed at her belly.
"Oh, my. Yes."
Flood glowered.
"Yes, yes, oh, yes,"
she said. She licked at her lips. "What was all that about?" Fool asked. "You two are having a fight." Flood grunted and crackled the pages of the paper before him and seemed not to understand.
"Nothing in the Telegraph about the painting," he said.
Fool leaned forward in his chair. "We'll negotiate it back with Mr. Farquhar directly," he said. "That should keep the police out of the matter. We'll sail for New York out of Liverpool immediately. That will mean limited tickets. We may not all be travelling together."
"Just as well,"
muttered Flood.
"And then where, Adam?"
"I was thinking San Francisco," Fool said with a smile. "To begin." Just then Mrs. Sykes came at an angle through the door with her strong arms outstretched and the wide silver tray low before her. She set the biscuits down in front of Molly and poured a cup of tea for the child, and a second one for Fool, and all the while Flood sat with his big hands before him on the table and said not a word, and he watched her every move. She did not look at him.
"Mr. Fool, sir,"
she said, with a dip of her head.
"Miss Molly."
But her bonnet had been straightened, Fool saw, her stray hair tucked up under. She was wearing a fresh white apron that seemed to glow where it traced the bloom of her hips. In the first 2 years of the war, the Major ran a network of spies throughout the American South, recording troop numbers, morale, condition of railroads, cost of food staples. He used runaway slaves, deserters, civilians seeking to cross the lines, prisoners of war. For the most precise and delicate tasks, he used a cadre of volunteer operatives, sent into the Confederate cities with falsified papers and credible stories. The greatest of these last was the Englishman, Timothy Webster. Tall, thin, clean-shaven, with long aristocratic fingers and fine leather breeches, and a case of cigars for each officer he met. Webster travelled in a private coach under the guise of an English lord touring the battlefields, and he soon fell into the confidences of the Confederate elite. He worked Richmond and sent reports back every fortnight. Then, in January 1862, word came north that Webster was seriously ill, and the report ceased, and in March the Major sent two operatives, John Scully and Price Lewis, south, to bring the man back. Lewis, a fiery riverboat gambler before the war, had interrogated a Confederate sympathizer in Washington in 1861, and this very sympathizer, a young woman, recognized him on his second afternoon in Richmond. Before nightfall, he and Scully found themselves arrested at gunpoint. The Confederate spymaster, a man named Cashmire, beat them both senseless and left them in separate cells.
"Cashmire," the Major swore when he heard. The bastard's a devil. Mr. Lewis and Mr. Scully wouldn't never betray Tim, Ben said. He'd be all right.
Edward, standing at the door of the tent, said nothing. In the following days, the Major, doubtful, paced and swore and barked out letters to his superiors in Washington. He feared Webster feverish and frail would soon be arrested. But Washington refused to negotiate, and Mr. Lincoln did not reply directly, and the secretary insisted that the Union did not employ spies, and so could not vouch for the release of any such prisoners. Then, in the middle of April, Timothy Webster was carried out of his hotel on a cot, too weak to walk, and taken to the Richmond prison.
"They mean to hang him," the Major said hoarsely to Edward and Spar.
Spar rapped a knuckle twice on the desk.
"You mean to exchange him? They don't hang our people. They don't hang ours, and we don't hang theirs."
The Major's mouth was tight, his lips bloodless.
"And the others, sir?"
Edward asked.
"Lewis and Scully?"
"They'll rot in prison. I know what those places are like. They'll be dead by Christmas from a plague."
The Major dropped his cigar into the mud in disgust and walked away. Something turned in him, flared, caught the light along its own fineness like a razor. Pinkerton did not return to the Emporium. As the days passed, Fool's uneasiness began to fade back into noise, and in its place he started to work out the theft with his old obsessive drive. He and Molly and Flood watched Bond Street and recorded the hours of the night watchman on his rounds. Flood took down a detailed description of the locks on the doors of the gallery, and Molly learned what she could of the night watchman. He was an old sailor with thick wrists and a slight limp, and he lived alone across the city. Flood raised his eyes at that, but Fool made a dismissive gesture with his fingers. He wanted no violence, and he wanted no witnesses. Every second evening all that week, they walked from Half Moon Street to the gallery without hurrying, and they timed the distance and wrote down any interruptions or obstacles as they found them. One afternoon they climbed to the rooftop of the bazaar across the street and stood at the stone balustrade with an unrolled copy of the floor plans of the gallery and peered across at its windows and tried to find some way to enter. They knew the doors required two keys for each lock, and they knew the galleries themselves were locked after closing. They did not know if the upper windows could be opened. On the sills were iron railings with spikes to discourage the pigeons, and the sills themselves were very narrow. It seemed, Fool thought, possible. Flood returned from a pawn shop in Whitechapel with three shabby old paintings, and Fool laid them out in his study on the floor. One by one he cut them carefully from their frames with different sized blades. They did not go into the gallery again. It was on Thursday in the dark hours of the morning that Fool descended to the kitchen and worked the knife sharpener with his foot, and held the small, narrow jemmy against the stone, and shaved it to a fine point. The jemmy was threaded at one end, and he unscrewed the end of his walking stick and fit the piece into the hollow there, and then re-screwed everything into place. He had brought his black frock coat with him, and he laid it open on the carving table, and over the inner stitching he ran his fingers until he found the loop of fabric, and this he pulled. Two knots of strong cording fell out. He rolled open the heavy oilcloth bundle, and its contents clattered softly as he did so, and then he stood studying the picks and skeleton keys and tiny blades gleaming there. He removed only three, and these he attached at either end to the knots, so that they did not rattle, and then he closed the oilcloth and tied it fast, and lifted up the frock coat, and dusted it, and set it to hang on a peg of the door. He took down a large bottle of paste from an upper shelf, and poured several heavy dollops into an empty jar, and screwed the lid into place. On the floor was a simple wooden doorstop, and he stood looking at it a moment, and on a whim he bent down and took that also. He took a stick of chalk, cool and silky in his fingers, and broke it in two, slipped each half into a separate pocket. Then he stood listening, rubbing the dust from the pads of his fingers with his handkerchief as he did so, as if he could erase all trace of himself. They had decided on Saturday night for the theft. It would be Valentine's Day, the night of Farquhar's dinner party, and Fool had one last errand still to complete. He needed to get close to Farquhar. He needed a copy of the man's keys. Saturday, he thought. All was silent. He cradled the candle. He went back up. When he found the Major chewing at an unlit cigar on the river landing at dusk, he was astonished to see his cheeks wet, and when Alan Pinkerton only shook his head and handed him the newspaper article, he too feared he might weep. Timothy Webster had been hanged on a grassy field outside Richmond. The crowds had gathered by the thousands, and stood crookedly on the beds of wagons, and propped telescopes on the open doors of carriages as Webster walked the steps of the scaffold. He died well, by all accounts, and when the noose had been fastened to his neck, he had been heard to say, "Make it tight." None of that had mattered. The drop had been sharp and the rope slipped, and Webster had landed in a crumpled heap under the scaffold, wheezing in pain. They had dragged him back onto the platform, the crowd hollering all the while. When they drew the noose again tight, he had cried out in protest, but then the drop fell open, and his neck snapped like a chicken bone, and he kicked and shat himself, and swung slowly and was still. All this Edward saw in his mind's eye, and he put his hand on the Major's sleeve and felt something like compassion. The Major did not shake him off. That was the 28th of April, 1862. The Army of the Potomac had been ferried south and established its perimeter on the banks of the James in the days preceding, and was preparing its slow advance on Richmond. It was the very day Edward first heard about the Major's son. Standing at the troughs with Spar, his balloonist's cap tucked up under one arm, the slow pines swaying on a rise beyond the river. The Major's eldest was to come down for the siege of Richmond, like an underclassman on his holiday. "It's not like that," Spar said. "Major's more proud of that boy than anything. Do him a world of good, having him down here."
"What's he like?"
"Willie?" Spar grinned. "Like chewing a mouthful of nails, I'd guess. A bit like you, kid." Edward kicked his way back down to the river but did not see the Major, and that night he lay awake with his hands cradling his head, and he stared through the tent flap at the stars. The spies Lewis and Scully were suffering in a prison somewhere in the rat's nest of Richmond. He thought of the stockade at Camp Barry, its blood-soaked straw where he had stared down his own execution. The Major's grief over Timothy Webster's hanging had been genuine, shocking, and then he could not help himself, and he tried to imagine what the boy, Willie, must be like. An underclassman, with a straw boater and silk waistcoat, and soft, clean fingers. Dazzling teeth, a rose in his lapel. Edward's tent was downwind of the latrines. The stink and flies was savage. He raised his eyes, arguing something with himself. The stars in their gauzy silver spirals, the snoring and coughing of men all around. This was the filth of his world. In the morning he rose early and went down to the river and dipped his hair and washed out his mouth. Then he trudged back up past the sentries, and at the Major's tent he went in unannounced, and when the Major lifted his tired eyes from the map of Richmond laid out before him, Edward crushed his hat in his hands and said, angrily, "I'll go. I'll break Lewis and Scully out." The Major regarded him.
"You won't," he said. "If the grey coats catch you, there'll be no trial, lad. They'll string you up like a horse thief, leave you to rot on the rope."
"Yes, sir."
The Major grunted, screwed up one sleep-bruised eye.
"Good lad," he said.
30. William sucked at his cheeks and bit into the angry flesh and crossed Piccadilly at a jog. He found Shaw lurking under the arch at Hyde Park Corner, with the buttons of his coat loose and his silk hat tipped back on his head, and he took the man roughly by the elbow and pulled him aside.
"You told me Edward Shade died in the war," he said.
Shaw looked up at him, startled.
"William," he said. "He didn't. He's here. In London."
Shaw shook him off, glowered and brushed at his sleeves.
"What is it with you Pinkertons?" he muttered. "You're all mad."
The cold park was busy. A a bright sun flaring against the old Iron Duke with his finger upraised on his frozen charger. In the beyond, a dark blue sky stretched deep and clear and roofless in the cold. "He calls himself Adam Fool," William said, "but it's Shid." There were ladies rustling past in fur collars and with opened parasols, turning on their stalks, as if it were spring already, and not just some reprieve from the greyness. There were gentlemen with small white dogs on leashes, breath pluming out before them.
"Adam Fool," Shaw said. "I know that name."
"How do I know that name?"
"I asked you about him."
Shaw grunted.
"Why? You were looking into that bastard Cooper."
The chief inspector was studying William as he would a feral creature trapped in a coal scuttle. He looked disbelieving and then indignant, and underneath it William could see a third thing, a kind of pity. He nodded towards the gate and started to walk.
"Tell me," he said.
So William told. It was not his habit to bring men into his confidence, and he spoke haltingly, cautiously, even now. Everywhere were the crowds, men in heavy coats, walking horses, ladies in top hats riding side saddle, nannies with prams jouncing and creaking. William recounted the gradual drift of his activities, the encounter in the tunnel, his expedition through the sewers and into Shadwell. Shaw knew something already of his meeting with Reckitt in Millbank, but he recounted it in greater detail. He told of the seance and the man Fool's horror when the spirit called to him by name. He told of Sally Porter's letter. As he talked, they passed ragged figures curled against the trees, feet tucked up under, and hot cider cellars and carts steaming with beef pies and potatoes roasting in their skins. Shaw listened. The grass in Hyde Park was dead, scruffed at the bases of the wooden posts.
"There's something between Shade and Charlotte Reckitt and Reckitt's uncle," William said. "Some history there. I haven't got it all sorted yet. Charlotte and Shade were lovers."
"And that's why she jumped that night.
On Blackfriars, maybe."
Shaw grunted.
"There's always some damned history. Hell of a couple of months you've had. You've been busy yourself."
"Aye. Fenians and muggings and this bloody business coming up in the papers.
Did I tell you about the department review? Fat lot of nonsense. My father used to carve a pig into trotters of a morning and wipe down his apron by noon. Old bastard never knew how lucky he was."
"Then on to the next pig, though."
Shaw smiled bitterly.
"Aye. There was always a next pig to stick."
He shook his head.
"So, you sail over to confront Reckitt, because there's a chance she's an old acquaintance of Shade. She dies. The business looks to be left unfinished. But you meet a man later, with a lead on the Reckitt woman's murder, and he turns out to be, according to a ghost, tell me I've got it wrong, none other than Edward Shade himself."
William took a long, ragged breath.
"I know how it sounds. You have no evidence. Nothing. Only a damned spirit conjuring and your own conjecture."
"It's him, John."
"Listen, William, your conjecture is worth a hell of a lot more than any other man's, at least to me. You must know that. But speaking as a chief inspector and not as your friend, I'd be negligent if I didn't tell you this sounds damned thin."
"I know it."
"You tell this to anyone else, you'd be laughed back to Chicago."
Shaw started to walk again, slowly.
"I'd half expected to get back from Brighton and find you sailed for New York. I'd thought you might have let it go. Got back to your own life."
"You never did."
Shaw glanced at him and then away as if not quite satisfied, and at last he said,
"I'm damned sorry about your father, William. You know I am."
He could feel the chief inspector's small eyes on him. He wondered briefly if the man had known already about his investigation into Fool, but dismissed it. He thought of Fool in that tunnel under the Thames, and the regret in his face. And he thought of the man's strange violet eyes at the seance. There was the weight of his small, hard body as they collapsed in the sewers, and the ferocity in his visage as he stood wavering over William in that alley, wiping blood from the head of his walking stick. He thought of all this. And he thought of the articulated precision in the man's voice when he spoke, as if placing each word, one by one, down. "So what is it you want?" Shaw said. "If you're not mad as a hatter, that is." William gave him a long, slow, dark look. "I want Edward Shane. I want him to answer for what he's done."
"And just what exactly is that? Do you have a single particular offence that you can charge the man with? Anything?"
Shaw hooked his stubby fingers over his lapel, and the hand hung there, a red crab-like thing in the cold. "I'll be frank, William. I'm not convinced you found the man, and I'm not convinced the man's a criminal. If you want my assistance, you need to convince me. Find me a reason. Find me evidence of a crime. Until then, anything you do to this Mr. Fool is done to an innocent citizen. You understand what I'm saying?"
William ran an angry hand over his mustaches. "You met with Shade in the Thames Tunnel, you say. How did you find him? Your father was looking for years. Ben Porter was looking."
William hesitated. "I didn't. You didn't. I didn't find him, John. He found me."
William rubbed at his wrists in the cold. His bad knee was aching.
"I know what you're thinking, but I think maybe he's been trying to tell me something."
"Like what?"
He turned his palms up. "I don't know."
There came a low thump from somewhere ahead of them, and then a ricochet rolled back towards them from the trees, and William knew it for what it was. The sound of a gunpowder trace going off. He could see the silhouettes of skaters gliding along the ice of the Serpentine, unconcerned, and he raised an eyebrow and Shaw shrugged. He said the explosion would be from some lunatic blowing a hole in the ice so he could bathe. William thought he must be joking, but as they passed over the stone bridge, he could see at the north end of the waterway a mound of block ice tumbled there, a slash of dark water opened and gleaming in the rough green surface. He felt unexpectedly deflated, lessened by the admissions. Saying it all aloud had made it sound half-crazed, and he knew Shaw's doubts were sensible.
"Tell me about the racket case," he said, shifting the focus of their talk. "Any progress?"
"Charlotte bloody racket," Shaw growled. "I'd have pitched her head back in the drink with my own bare hands if I'd thought it would drag out like this."
"Blackwell's no closer then."
He barked a laugh.
"Mr. Blackwell has his notions. Thinks the evidence suggests a crime of passion. Thinks he has the pub and even the man responsible, seeing as the man's wife matches Charlotte Reckitt's description and has been missing a month. He believes there's a cellar on the premises that might contain Dr. Breck's sawdust and insects."
Shaw squinched up an eye.
"I told him if he thinks he can close the case quickly, I don't care if it's the bloody footman to the Queen."
"A crime of passion," William said. "Nothing to do with Charlotte Reckitt."
"Aye. The publican's dear wife is in France, he's told, visiting relatives. Might not ever return, he's told. Some kind of a row between them. She's up and off to her mother without a word to anyone. Hardly a stitch of her clothing packed and taken."
"How sure is he?"
"Not very. Not yet.
If that wasn't Charlotte Reckitt fished up out of the river,
I wouldn't put too much stock in Mr. Blackwell's notions just yet," Shaw said. "I've been a police detective 27 years, William. The simplest explanation is always the right one.
Except when it's not."
Shaw gave him a queer, sidelong look, and William raised his eyebrows, and then the two men smiled. William did not mention his conversation with the inspector in the records closet. On a low knoll ahead, a hot air balloon drifted at its tethers in the dead grass. Men in heavy coats and scarves leaned into the anchor ropes to hold the basket in place, and the balloon was painted red and white, with an advertisement for Pear soap curving across its face. Two ladies in winter shawls clambered aboard, and the aeronaut loosened a bag of sand, and the basket rocked and began to drift upward. The ladies shrieked and laughed and clutched at their hats with gloved hands. The crowd broke into muffled applause. The balloon lifted higher and higher, its long, slouching tethers sloping down from that other world of buckling winds, of drenching light. It was then